From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up today, Detroit's budget deficit balloons to $327 million. Is the city out of time and options?
And you know, you really have to have everybody on board moving forward together to get some of the really dramatic changes that they're looking for.
And we talk with newly retired State Supreme Court Justice Marilyn Kelly.
It's a national embarrassment that candidates for the Supreme Court are nominated by a political party. This is the only state in the union that does that.
Plus, we look at the growing business of garbage.
The average American produces, it's something like 4.5 pounds of trash per day.
And hockey returns to Hockey Town.
Federal government can do some very worthwhile things, and one of them was bringing hockey back.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Happy Monday. Quick, did you forget to take out the trash this morning? Better yet, do you ever wonder where all of your trash ends up? We dig into the big business of garbage coming up in today's show. Also, Detroit is facing an even bigger deficit, $327 million and growing. Is the city running out of time and running out of options? But first, news coming out of Lansing. The Michigan Supreme Court will be asked for the first time to suspend a sitting justice for misconduct. The Michigan Judicial Tenure Commission has filed a formal complaint against Justice Diane Hathaway. She is accused of ethics violations for allegedly using property swaps to arrange a short sale that saved her hundreds of thousands of dollars. In six separate counts, the Judicial Tenure Commission alleges that Hathaway committed fraud, money laundering, and that she lied to the commission to cover it all up. You can find up-to-the-minute information about the Hathaway story online at michiganradio.org. Speaking of the Michigan Supreme Court, Justice Marilyn Kelly retired last week, but not by choice. The 74-year-old Kelly could not run again because the state constitution bars judicial candidates from seeking office if they're 70 years of age or older. Kelly was Chief Justice for 2 years, but the Democrats spent most of her 16 years in the minority on the Supreme Court, as conservative Republicans controlled the court 4-3. Former Justice Marilyn Kelly joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's be crystal clear. You would have kept serving if Michigan's constitution allowed, correct?
I certainly would have run again and would have hoped the people would have again elected me.
You were elected in 1996 to the state Supreme Court, so you've had many, many years, even serving as Chief Justice, as we mentioned, for 2 years. So looking back, tell us what are you most proud of? What's been the best part of your job for you?
Well, I've been, frankly, delighted to have the opportunity to help shape the law in the state. Within the court, we've instituted a recusal rule, which even the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't have, which gives the opportunity to litigants to ask a justice to step down from a case if that litigant feels the justice is prejudiced or biased. In the past, if the justice refused to step down, there was no recourse. Now, with this new recusal rule, there is a recourse. I think the court's made some good decisions over the years. I certainly haven't approved of many, but it has made good decisions, such as the decision to continue to allow people to walk along the water's edge of our Great Lakes, to have standing to bring an action to save the environment, to be able to prevent the government from taking their land for non-public use. Those are just some of the opinions I've been on that I've been proud of.
You've been very clear in your opposition to some of these key decisions, particularly ones that have tightened access to the trial courts, especially in injury cases. Talk to us about some of your frustrations.
It's frustrating to me to realize that some on the court believe that the legislature really does intend to make it harder for people to use the courts when they're injured in an automobile accident, a slip and fall injury on the premises of a business, or, for example, when they're the victim of malpractice, either legal or medical.
Why do you think that is? I'm sure there have been many discussions.
There certainly have.
So the view for restricting is what? What do you hear? Certainly you don't support it.
The view for restricting is that there's a limit to what the courts can do to protect people's rights. The people really don't want this kind of recourse to be available to people, that the legislators don't intend it when they write certain laws. But frequently it is a question of just how the court interprets the language that's used.
By the legislature. So your
feet. Right.
Now, I would suspect some of this stems from those so-called nuisance suits, which everyone knows
it
happens. So what is your view as to why the access should be broadened?
You know, there have been nuisance suits, certainly over the years, and courts are generally not sympathetic to them. I think the general public is given to believe that people tend to recover large amounts of money in these nuisance suits, and although I think normally it just simply doesn't happen. And so people are unnecessarily concerned about that.
Are you saying it pretty well gets squashed in the lower courts before it would ever make it to the state Supreme Court?
That's right.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside, and I'm Cynthia Canty. We're talking now with the newly retired state Supreme Court Justice Marilyn Kelly, who, because of age limitations spelled out in Michigan's Constitution, going back to 1906, she was not allowed to run for re-election. Now, Marilyn, you've been very critical, and it seems so have the other justices, about the way Michigan's Supreme Court justices are elected. Spell out your concerns for us.
Yes, my concern is that our system of choosing state Supreme Court justices has become too politicized, and it started to involve much more money than we're accustomed to, and that the source of that money and the amount is not easily identified and at times can't be identified at all. So over the years that I've been in public office, we've seen the amount spent on these races jumping from maybe $500,000 to $15 million. Clearly something's going on and changes in the law are needed in order to control this this potential for abuse.
And what changes would you make in the way candidates run for seats?
I think that the legislature should enact changes to the campaign finance laws. This would be easy to do. It would simply require that money going into these Supreme Court races be identified so the public can find out the source of the funds, and that that identification involve disclosure before an election, so that people can find out who's paying for the ads that they see on television.
That sounds like something that is going to be a cause near and dear to your heart going forward.
It is. And a task force that Judge Ryan and I set up last year has recommended these changes. We've taken the question to the governor and to the key legislators, and we're hoping that in 2013 they'll see their way clear to enact these changes. We know that the general public wants them.
I think we got a sense of that with this last campaign and the flood of advertisements. And it seems as we were profiling and spoke with all the candidates, and no one of the candidates or the sitting justices seemed happy with the system as it exists that you have to work under at this point.
That's right. It's an embarrassment. It's a national embarrassment that candidates for the Supreme Court are nominated by a political party. This is the only state in the union that does that. It would be easy for the legislature to change the laws and provide for open, nonpartisan primaries for the Supreme Court.
Well, in your early discussions, have you and Justice Ryan received any kind of sense from the governor or from lawmakers that they were open to reform?
Well, the door's not closed.
Okay.
But beyond that, I can't assure you that that the changes that are needed are going to happen, although I'm convinced that if our legislators heard from us enough, they would get the message and make the changes.
So in essence, it sounds like you're challenging people listening to you right today, the voters of Michigan, to speak out.
That's right. It's surprising what influence you can have by writing your legislator or telephoning and simply indicating that you want to see something done.
What is it like? And we've had a chance now to talk to some folks. We talked to David Curson, who had his 7 weeks in Congress, and can give a perspective that the rest of us can only wonder about. And the same for you. When issues and cases are presented to the Supreme Court in Michigan, what's it like and what's the dialogue and the conversation like as you're coming down with your rulings?
Well, it's an amazing process. There are seven of us, and we read briefs, and then we hear oral argument, and then we sit and discuss the merits of the case and vote and decide who's going to write an opinion. And ultimately, when that opinion is written and circulated, if someone disagrees, dissents are written and circulated. And in the course of all of that, there's a great deal of of thought given to the results that we are coming up with. Because we all know on the court that our decisions not only resolve the case before us, but that case stands as precedent for future cases that are like it.
So, Marilyn Kelly, looking back now with your 16 years of experience on the high court and now your concerns looking ahead, what challenges do you think Michigan's Supreme Court faces going forward?
The high court, and in fact all courts, are facing, I think, the paramount problem is the high cost of four people to be involved in court cases. It's become a game that's available to the wealthy. Even middle-income people find it overwhelming to go through litigation in our courts. We have to find ways to cut down the costs. For example, we find that up to 40% of people in some courtrooms are unrepresented by a lawyer because they simply can't afford one.
Hmm.
I set up a task force that has established a website and a self-help center, which is called Michigan Legal Help, and that endeavors to help people learn at least what's expected of them and what forms to use when they get in a courtroom, and helps them find a lawyer if and when they realize that they absolutely must use one. We need to improve our funding for indigent criminal defense in the system. It's one of the very worst in the whole country. It's a scandal.
Huh.
We need to find ways to, and the state Supreme Court needs to adopt guidelines for judges to use in selecting interpreters for those who are in the courts and don't understand English. We have a great many of those people. The Department of Justice is concerned that Michigan's has not yet established guidelines. That question is before the court right now.
It certainly seems there's a common theme in your concerns over some of the decisions you have not agreed with, and you're looking ahead as far as the challenges. It really comes down to access and letting people get full access to the legal system.
You're absolutely right, Cindy. It's very perceptive. That's my biggest concern.
Former Michigan Supreme Court Justice Marilyn Kelly, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, hockey is returning to Hockey Town. That story coming up in 15 minutes. This is Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The grim news just keeps on coming. That seems to be the case anytime you talk about the city of Detroit and its money miseries. The latest bad news comes from an independent annual audit that finds Detroit's deficit has ballooned to nearly $327 million. Detroit Free Press editorial writer Nancy Caffer joins us now with more. Nancy, if there was a clock and midnight was, City of Detroit, meet your new state-appointed emergency manager. How close do you think the city is to midnight?
Cindy, that's a very hard question to answer, because a year ago I would have told you that I thought we were almost there.
Yeah.
And it's a year later, and so they seem to keep finding ways to not have that happen, which I understand. The state doesn't want to put a manager in Detroit. Detroit definitely doesn't want a manager, emergency manager. But you think that they're at the point where something has to happen, and then they find a way to kind of extend that horizon. So are we closer to an emergency manager at this time than we were a year ago? I would say yes, we almost have to be, but how close are we? My gut is really off on this one.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, Nancy, that you know, the consent agreement and all the things that have happened over 2012 that have kept the emergency manager at bay. And look where you are now, City of Detroit, with even a worse deficit. That $327 million figure is pretty eye-popping. And how did that compare to the deficit from the year earlier?
It's $130 million more.
So there's even more red ink being bled at a faster rate.
Yeah, it wasn't entirely unexpected, though. They knew that the deficit was going to grow because a lot of the cuts that the mayor and council have tried to put in place have not happened. Mm-hmm. Changes to the workforce, changes to work rules. They know that these things have not happened.
Why haven't they?
Well,
many reasons.
We could figure that out. We would be able to solve all the city's problems.
Sure,
there's been a lack of, there's a relatively dysfunctional relationship between the mayor and the council. There's a relatively dysfunctional relationship between the unions and both of those in the mayor and the council. I mean, and you really have to have everybody on board moving forward together to get some of the really dramatic changes that they're looking for, and that has not happened. I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that at this point the consent agreement has not worked.
Mm-hmm.
The reforms that they said needed to get done haven't really gotten done. Very late in 2012, the council did approve a number of key contracts that the state had really said you have to get these things done in order to get money from an escrow account that's going to keep you afloat for the next couple months.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were able to approve some of these reform-minded contracts. But, there just has not been the progress that I think anyone wanted to see.
And I noted in the Detroit Free Press story that was done, it was Matt Helms who put it together, that he tried to get reaction from city council and just couldn't. So no one has stepped up or the mayor's office to comment on this at all?
We did get it late in the day during holiday week, so I wouldn't want to point the
finger
at them too harshly on this one.
Yeah.
But now, what is interesting is that tomorrow, council is back in session. It's their first formal session after their recess. And they have they're going to start negotiating on some pretty significant cuts that the mayor is proposing that are part of some of the reform things they need to get done. He's going to call for a one-year freeze on pension credits for employees in the city's retirement system, a 70-30 health care plan, and furloughs for non-union staff that's equal to a 20% pay cut. So here are some things. They've had furloughs in the past that were equal only to a 10% pay cut, but they're looking at 20% going forward. And this is some stuff that is pretty serious moves, and this is what austerity at least the start of austerity looks like. I mean, it's easy to sit back and say they need to cut salaries, they need to do this, that, and the other, but when you think about your own paycheck, if you think about taking a 20% cut, that's pretty hard.
Yes.
So these are some of the serious moves that I think that have been being put off are in the works here, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens tomorrow when council goes back into session.
As my mother used to say, it is truly time to pay the piper.
It is, and it's unfortunate that this is what's happening because, the city does need workers, and it does need qualified, educated, skilled workers to do some of the very complicated policy things that they have to do. And I don't think anybody's happy about taking a 20% pay cut in their work, and I don't know what that's going to do to their ability to keep things going personnel-wise. But that's only for non-union workers.
Well, Nancy, this figure, this $327 million deficit, this does not come from that state order deep dive into the city's books, the one being led by Treasurer Andy Dillon. Are you hearing anything about that review? Could it bring even worse news?
Worse news?
Yeah.
How could there be worse news? No, this is the state-required audit that just, as you know, the state or every city in Michigan puts out a budget and spring, and then at the end of 6 months after the close of their fiscal year, they have to do this audit that shows kind of how they did in terms of what they said they were going to spend and what they said they were going to spend money on and what they were going to save. This audit is sort of the reckoning. Now, the state probe will certainly be looking at this audit. It will be a piece of what they're looking at. So.
If the city does wind up getting an emergency manager, in your opinion, as you look at all the parties involved, who would be the winners and losers in that?
That, you know, I mean, a friend of mine likened the appointment of an emergency manager to sort of an intervention that you do with someone who has a serious problem of some type, that in the short term, it probably would be pretty rough. You know, the very austere cuts that we're seeing the mayor start to ask for here probably be implemented on a broader level, you know, to all employees.
Union and non-union.
Yeah, I mean, if that were something that were possible because of the, obviously, the state's emergency manager laws and the situation of flux, you know, it would be very hard in the short term. But the theory is that if you take this short-term pain, in the long term, you will have a better city, or at least a more financially healthy city. And that's sort of the whole point behind having an emergency manager, is that in the short term, we would probably see some relatively unpleasant things happen in terms of budget, I should clarify.
Yes, yes.
Budget.
Thanks so much for talking with us today, Nancy.
Thank you, Cindy. Always a pleasure.
Nancy Kaffer is an editorial writer with the Detroit Free Press. And turning now from the money troubles plagguing the city of Detroit to cash-strapped Wayne County. A report in the Sunday Detroit Free Press revealing that Wayne County may be short on cash, but certainly not on appointees. This is the first look at the entire government of Wayne County. Reporter John Wisely joins us now. Welcome to Stateside, John.
Thank you, Cindy. Glad to be here.
Well, this issue of Robert Ficano, the Wayne County executive, and his appointees really bubbled to the forefront when his appointee, Turkia Awada-Mullen, of course, was awarded that $200,000 severance payment when she stepped down as chief development officer to go to Metro Airport. Give us a little refresher course on what that was about, because I think it kind of sets the stage for what you discovered about appointees in Wayne County.
Yeah, it really was. It did kind of reveal the sort of indulgence that the county has towards some of its higher-up employees, the people who are appointed directly by the executive or other elected officials. And they, you know, of course, they didn't tell anybody about the $200,000 severance package. You know, it came out because of good reporting. So once it did come out, people realized that, wow, they really do indulge these people. And it prompted a lot of scrutiny in terms of some of the other things they do. And we learned about, you know, things like a 5-to-1 401k match, which most people in the private sector would kill to have. Some of the people who were allowed to transfer in from a 401k benefit, style benefit, you know, which goes up and down with the market, into a defined benefit pension plan, which is guaranteed by the taxpayers. That's created an enormous liability for taxpayers going forward. Lifetime health care benefits that were awarded to people with as little as 8 years of service in certain positions. And a lot of these benefits are really kind of much more generous than people in the private sector would expect, and they're kind of surprised to read about them in county government. And now the county governments and local governments of all sorts, you mentioned the city of Detroit, they're all hurting now because of the property tax decline.
Right.
And so they really have to examine their costs. So it does raise the question of, if you're trying to rein in the costs, why are you still providing benefits that far exceed anything?
And it wasn't just these incredibly generous benefits. Also, I tell you what made my eyes pop was just the sheer number of appointees in Wayne County, starting with appointees made by County Executive Ficano. Give us a compare and contrast with his appointees versus what you see in Oakland and Macomb counties.
Yeah, he has, right now, I think he's at about 175, 178. It bounces up and down a little bit. When you compare that with Brooks Patterson in Oakland County, he's got about 21. Mark Hackle in Macomb County has about 14. And, you know, the government ethics people tell us that there's a certain number of appointees are appropriate. You know, you're not going to do without a corporation counsel, a lawyer who's the top lawyer, and that person's going to be appointed because he needs to share the philosophy of the executive. You're not going to do without, say, an undersheriff or somebody like that.
Sure.
So there's certainly a number that anyone would justify. Most elected officials have a confidential secretary. If they're negotiating with the union for a contract, you wouldn't want your secretary to be a member of the union, so you'd have that person would be exempt, so they would be quote-unquote an appointee. So a small number of them, I think, is acceptable even, you know, for most folks. But when you get to see, you know, plus 100, 150, 170, at one point there were over 200, and then The Free Press had reported last year that since Vacano's taken office, he's collected more than $600,000 in political contributions from county employees, the bulk of those people that he appointed directly. It really raises some questions.
And when I looked at that figure of that 174, give or take, does that big bloated number, does that predate Robert Vacano? Is that kind of the track record in Wayne County?
It does, and in fairness to Vacano, that number has come down. I mean, under his predecessor, Ed McNamara, that number, according to the Vacano people, was up as high as 300 at different points. The one difference there was a lot of those McNamara appointees worked at Metro Airport. And Metro Airport, if you recall, was spun off. McNamara and then Governor John Engler basically broke it off from county government and put it under the under an authority. And so those appointees are no longer counted towards the executive's number. So that's a big reason that a lot of those numbers have come down. But it's still big. And when you tally up the annual cost, it's almost $50 million a year.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Detroit Free Press reporter John Wisely about his front page story yesterday, looking at the costs and the sheer numbers of political appointees in Wayne County, and certainly comparing to surrounding counties, Oakland, Macomb County. You talk about the fringe benefit rate, that eye-popping 81%. What does that actually mean if I'm a Wayne County taxpayer?
That's where you get at the, you know, some of the more than, you know, the benefits that are more generous than what you'd see in the private sector. So, for instance, I think the average Wayne County appointee, I think we had it in there, makes about $95,000. Just for math purposes, let's say it's 100.
Right.
So if they're paying somebody $100,000, they've got to set aside another $81,000 on top of that $100,000 salary to cover benefits. And a big chunk of that is the unfunded liability on the county's pension program. They have they're about $800 million short of what they're going to need to pay the bills over the next 30 years. And you don't have to pay all that in 1 year, but you have to work it down each year. So what the actuary says to them from the pension plan is you're going to have to increase the contribution to the pension plan to shore up this unfunded liability. So that's how you get to 81% fringe factor. They also have health care and life insurance and disability you know, benefits that are in there as well, but the big driver on all that is the unfunded liability on the pension plan.
And that kind of leads me to wonder, John Wisely, what message do you think Wayne County citizens and voters should take away from your story?
You know, I think they really need to be vigilant about their government at all levels, not just in Washington where, you know, we get a lot of attention, but your local government as well. They spend a lot of money. They make promises in your name. When they grant a pension promise, they're essentially, you know, that politician might be voted out of office in 2 years, but that pension promise is going to be around for 20 or 30 or 40 years or however long those appointees or those employees are going to live. And you need to benchmark them against other counties. I mean, Oakland is kind of seen as a model. They have really, I think their fringe factor is about 47%. They work pretty hard to keep it down, and they've got most of their new employees. They're not guaranteeing them a pension. They've got them in a 401k-style plan where they say, we will put in X amount per year, and then our commitment to you has ended. They're not promising you a benefit 30 years from now that says, when you're 72, we're going to pay you X amount, because those promises can be hard to keep based on what the market does.
Quite a lesson. John Wisely, Detroit Free Press reporter, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Cindy. Have a great day.
Drop that puck. Looks like hockey is back. Over the weekend, word came down that the NHL and the Players Association reached an agreement that could end their 113-day lockout. Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon joins us now. Hi, John.
Hello, Cindy. How are you?
Good, good. So what did it take to end this lockout?
It took a guy named Scott Beckenbaugh, a federal mediator who's got more brains and wisdom than the other two negotiators combined. So I can tell you this, the federal government can do some very worthwhile things, and one of them was bringing hockey back, not so much to the fans, but to the economies around those rinks that depend on these games, of course, to make their money. So good for him.
So could it still collapse, or does this look like a done deal?
Given the people involved, Cindy, I would never discount that idea, but it seems very unlikely. I know the players I've talked to, and I've talked to quite a few, are dying to get back and play some hockey, of course, and make some money in the process. What happened here in the first place, though, you've got Donald Fehr runs the Players Association for the NHL. You may recall him as the guy who canceled the World Series in 94.
That's right.
That's the one side. The other guy is Gary Bettman, almost universally considered the worst commissioner in the history of the four major sports.
Wow.
Just saying a lot.
Exactly.
Got a couple heavyweights here. He canceled the entire 2004-05 season. So given that history, what you have here is two suicidal maniacs playing chicken. You know how it's going to end. So Beckenbaugh steps in and saves them from themselves, basically. And they had 16 hours of negotiations there at the end, which ended at 5 a.m. Sunday morning. The whole idea was to lock the door and no one leave.
Okay.
But they kept Bettman and Fehr largely out of it. So what does that tell you?
That tells you a lot. That tells you a lot. And looking at the Wings, Nick Lidstrom is gone, and we hear that Thomas Holmstrom's about to retire. What do you think the year looks like for the Wings, and do you think the shortened season will help or hurt the Wings?
It will help the Wings. The season will probably cut, as you know, from 82 games down to 48, which I think is, frankly, much better hockey. 82 games is way, way too many for the fans and for the players, frankly. So this will be a lot better hockey. It's almost playoff hockey to begin with. The Wings are, by and large, an older team, even with Lidstrom gone. So this will help them tremendously. In a shorter season, they'll be a lot better rested, a lot better shape, and they've not been banged up all fall. So
yeah,
this helps them, I believe.
Now, we all know the Winter Classic. In fact, it's funny, though, on New Year's. Wasn't it supposed to be New Year's Day?
Yes.
There were so many things when I was looking at Facebook on New Year's Day. Oh, so excited to go to the Winter Classic in Ann Arbor. Oh, wait. No, I'm not. It was supposed to be at the Big House in Ann Arbor, and certainly was a casualty of the lockout. Will that matchup and the Michigan venue be pushed back to the next year's, to 2014?
It's not been certified yet, but I'm almost certain it will be played January 1st next year, 2014, in the Big House. That's too big a moneymaker, too big a deal, and all parties want it. So that's almost certainly going to happen.
So I'll look forward to cheering with you outside at the Big House January 1st, 2014.
Bring the flask.
There we go. John Eubanks, Michigan Radio Sports Commentator. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Up next, it's an engineering achievement that not many of us think about too often. Landfills. You'll want to listen to this before you take out your trash. Stay with us. This is Stateside, and I'm Cynthia Canty. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is all too easy to allow yourself to not spend much time at all thinking about our next subject, trash. Yep, you bag it up, you haul it out to the curb on trash day, then you drag the empty garbage cans back to the side of the garage, and maybe you'll toss your plastic bottles, cans, and newspapers into a recycling bin. But once that garbage truck lumbers off with your trash tucked inside, it's real easy not to give it a second thought. Writer Mark Kurlianchik decided to give our trash a more than second thought. His recent story in Our Detroit magazine called Waste Matters is a real entertaining eye-opener, both in terms of learning how much waste and trash we really generate and what you have to do with it. So Mark joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
What led you to take such a deep dive into what to many people is a fairly unappealing topic, and you made it really interesting?
Well, it's exactly what you were talking about in your opening. After the trash is gone, where does it go? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just one simple question, where does it go? So I decided to track it. That took me down this rabbit hole where this whole world of garbage really opened up for me. It's a really complex issue, and just in the state alone, there are so many different aspects of it. It's really tough to kind of get down into one, 3,500-word feature. So we had a little more fun with, bringing in some images and doing some fun illustrations to make it more accessible.
Well, one thing I learned when it comes to generating garbage, the USA can chant, we're number one because we are. What does being the world's number one producer of garbage really mean in terms of what you and I are producing every year?
Well, so the average American produces, it's something like 4.5 pounds of trash per day.
And you say in your story, that's about the weight of a MacBook.
Yeah, I figured that would be something that everyone kind of knows the weight of.
So that's each one of us every day.
Every day. And this is an average, of course.
Sure.
So some more, some less. But just to put into perspective, the U.S. makes up 4% of the world's population. But we generate 30% of the global waste.
So we're big old hogs.
Oh, yes, we are. And a lot of it has to do with our culture of consumerism. Since the 1960s, municipal solid waste generation, and that's all the stuff that you and I generate on a day-to-day basis that goes into just the regular trash can, has tripled. In the meantime, it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, and you find out into your story, you say more than half of that trash, the 250 million tons of trash, more than half goes into landfills. But before we get into landfills here in Michigan, what do we do with the rest of the trash?
It's either composted, recycled, or incinerated. Mm. Those are the three biggies.
All right, but let's talk landfills now. Yeah. You went to Pine Tree Acres Landfill, which just sounds serene and lovely.
And you know what? It was surprising that the area around it really is serene and lovely because there's a Wildlife Habitat Council certified wetlands that's protected by the landfill. And Waste Management, the company who runs Pine Tree Acres, has now protected something like 20,000 acres. And it's just something you don't think about, that next to a landfill you'd have wetlands and there's ducks and geese and frogs and deer, waterfowl. So from the top of the landfill, it was actually quite beautiful to see. And they keep the garbage relegated to just a small area of the landfill. But it was totally unexpected for me.
Well, there you were in northern Macomb County at Pine Tree Acres Landfill. And one expert did say to you, I think people would come away with a very different understanding if they visited a landfill. So apart from the fact that it was surrounded by some lovely area, what else surprised you and what did you learn?
Well, if there's one thing I can say, doing this story that I would recommend for all of our readers and all of your listeners is to just call up your landfill operator and ask for a tour. Many of them have a community relations representative. They do educational things. Schools come through. And a lot of them are open to it because I think that there's this great misconception about landfills. And it's something I had before I started the story. I kind of thought of it as just this open pit, a big hole in the ground
where you just festering garbage.
Yeah, you plow garbage into it and that's it. And that's just not the case. It used to be the case. It started to change in about 1970 when then former President Nixon created the EPA, and then Congress adapted some. We finally started to think about what we were doing to our environment, and I think things really started to change then. So back then we had something like 20,000 open dumps, and these were totally unregulated. A township could just have a big hole in the ground where they stuffed all their trash.
Okay. And then plowed it, covered it up.
Nowadays, exactly.
Eventually,
Nowadays, we're down to something like 1,900 across the entire country. So in the state of Michigan, we have about 50. It's 49 of these municipal solid waste landfills, and they're highly, highly regulated. I mean, it's a huge engineering feat. There's they have to prepare the land to accept trash, and it costs a lot of money to do. I mean, it's just not what you think of. They suck the gases that are created by the decomposing waste out of the landfill. There's groundwater wells, so they test the groundwater to make sure that it's not leaching out into the surrounding area. It's a feat of engineering, really.
And they even use the term leachate. Leachate.
Yeah,
that's
gross.
I just shudder to think what is in that leachate, but it's the liquids that come.
Correct.
But it's actually used in the landfill to help further the disintegration of the garbage.
Right. There's research that's been shown that the leachate, when it's reintroduced back, and I hope no one's eating lunch right now, as it's introduced back, it increases the temperature of the waste, and that speeds up the degradation process. So most of it is at least at Pine Tree Acres, is reintroduced back into the landfill, and then the rest is hauled away to a wastewater treatment facility.
What can you tell us? Waste Management's a huge company out of Texas, and it does seem from what you're describing, this is not something that lends itself to being a mom-and-pop operation.
No, absolutely not.
What's their track record? Are they very involved in these ones in Michigan?
With the landfills in Michigan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Waste Management is the number one.
Okay.
You know, there are some smaller operators, but they're the biggest one. But not only that, I think one of the other surprising things that I learned was that Waste Management is also the largest recycler in the country, in addition to being the largest waste management company. And now they're really starting to shift. These wetlands were part of a sustainability plan that they adopted in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes they're also starting to convert some of this landfill gas into energy. So Pine Tree Acres alone, this one, and I should say that it is the largest landfill in Michigan.
Okay, and it's there in Macomb County, so
correct.
It's in the Tri-County
Township
area.
Yeah, correct. So they generate there are two landfill gas to energy facilities. They take the methane out of the landfill and actually convert them through these engines into power, into electricity. It's pumped back into the grid, and something like 22,000 homes are powered by this landfill gas energy facility. So that's just one example of what Waste Management is starting to do.
What is it like being a neighbor of Pine Tree Acres?
Well,
is that a mixed blessing?
There's a thing with landfills. It's called not in my backyard, NIMBY, shorthand. We're fine with getting rid of our garbage and not seeing it again,
but unless
we live right next door to the landfill.
Right.
And there was a class action lawsuit filed by some of the neighbors at Pine Tree Acres or near or around Pine Tree Acres because there was debris blowing. There was
smells.
Smells, yeah. But part of that went into the settlement for this class action lawsuit. Part of it was this new landfill gas to energy facility, which is like a $15 million facility. And so in good faith, Pine Tree Acres built this facility, and that's supposed to help with the smell because it takes some of the gas out of the air and converts it into energy.
We're talking with writer Mark Kurlianchik, whose piece in Our Detroit magazine is called Waste Matters, looking at garbage and trash, and it was in the December 2012 issue of Our Detroit magazine. You know, Mark, I noticed it was startling how much cheaper it is for municipalities to get rid of their solid waste in Michigan landfills. I see $25 to $30 a ton.
Mm-hmm.
National average is $40 to $50 a ton. So why is Michigan such a garbage bargain?
Well, part of that has to do with the low state fees. It costs about 36 cents per ton is what the state charges. It's a state surcharge in Michigan for waste to be dumped in a landfill. By comparison, in Wisconsin, it's $13 a ton. Now, Wisconsin is the highest state, but you can see the difference, 36 cents a ton versus $13 a ton. So that's part of it. The second part of it is, and this is according to Mike Garfield of the Ecology Center right here in Ann Arbor, his reasoning for it was that in the 90s, Michigan was just citing landfills willy-nilly and kind of, we made more space than we needed for ourselves.
All right.
So as a result of that, we are now also the number three importer of out-of-state trash.
And is that a bad thing? I mean, I know we had a lot coming from Canada.
Yeah, it depends on who you ask because it is a business.
It's a business.
However, just a number to consider,
and
this comes from the Michigan Recycling Coalition. 10,000 tons of trash, of waste, let's call it waste.
Waste, okay.
10,000 tons of waste creates... To process that waste creates one landfill job, four jobs if it was composted, if possible, 10 jobs if it can be recycled.
Okay.
So it's, you know, importing waste is good for us because we also export a lot of waste. This is a huge regional operation. It's not something that we're just importing all the trash. Mm-hmm. We're also getting rid of some of our hazardous waste. We're sending it to Canada. However, it's just not economically feasible anymore. Mm. Because, you know, land, you can pay $25 a ton to a municipality, you can pay $25 a ton to dispose of it in landfills.
Right.
Or you can do something which waste management is starting to do and invest in some of these new technologies, which are actually taking hard-to-process materials that end up in waste.
Things like maybe disposable diapers?
Disposable diapers, yeah. Or
the grocery bags, the plastic grocery bags.
Well, those are tough. Those are very tough.
Yes, yes.
But things like small pieces of cardboard and plastic.
Okay.
And they're turning it into these pellets that can burn at nearly the same BTU as coal. And, of course, you can charge for selling these pellets.
Sure enough.
So, I mean, really the issue is we're just throwing – we're burying materials that we can do so much more with.
That's interesting. Now, Michigan's landfills, you know, are going to reach capacity in 24 years, yet you had experts saying, no, Mark, there's no crisis. Why is that?
Well, the 24-year number comes from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. And the way that they come up with that number, and it changes every year, it's based on cells that have already – a cell is just a portion of a landfill that can accept waste.
Okay.
It is based on cells that have already been sited. So that means that they've been approved to receive waste.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are more and more of these cells being built every year, and that doesn't include land that the landfill – like, say, Pine Tree Acres, they own land adjacent to the landfill.
So they can expand.
That they can expand to. They say that there are parts of it that they just own that they won't expand, but – you know, if worst comes to worst.
Mm-hmm.
So that 24-year number is a moving figure. And also because there are these new technologies coming aboard, including this leachate reintroduction, that are just – they're making things degrade faster and allowing us to basically make better use of the space that we have.
Let's talk about recycling. You say that's really an important thing.
And
what's Michigan's track record with recycling? Where do we stand compared to the rest of the country?
The biggest problem is that we just don't know anymore because our last comprehensive study of the recycling rate in Michigan was done in 2001.
Ooh.
Yeah, we don't have the money to even look at how we're doing. Exactly. Yeah, that one was funded with help from the EPA, done by the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, and it found that we were at 20%, which is well below the national average of 34%. Now, you look at a city like San Francisco, of course, they're a little more progressive. They have a good tax base. 80% they just surpassed.
Wow.
80%.
We have a long way to go.
We do have a long way to go.
Does that matter more in terms of policy or the market or personal responsibility? Or?
Well, that's great that you brought up all three because it really has to do with all three. Policy is important because right now, in 2007, then-Governor Granholm enacted our current solid waste policy, mm-hmm. which encourages a recycling rate of 50%. Now, if we were to get there, that would be about $500 million just in materials alone that we could sell or, you know, an economic benefit. However, it just encourages it. It doesn't actually provide any money for establishing infrastructure for that.
Okay.
So back to the Michigan Recycling Coalition, they've done a study that found that it would cost about $76 million in infrastructure upgrades, changes in policy. You know, I mean, we're talking single stream recycling processing facilities. Single stream, I should say, is you can put all of your recyclables in one container,
mm-hmm.
And you don't need to sort them.
That's what we have.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I throw in my if I can fit all my newspapers. If not, I put them in a separate brown bag. But yeah, we throw our plastic and our metal, and it all goes in the one tub.
So that's the policy angle. The market mm-hmm. is also starting to meet the demands of recycling because of the cost of materials. Plastic is starting, you know, we're realizing that, hey, it's easier to just reuse this stuff than make it brand new again. And then the third leg is, as you mentioned, personal responsibility. Every time that you throw out, you know, a newspaper and you throw it into the trash rather than the recycling bin, mm-hmm. you are in essence voting for landfills and voting to dispose of the waste in this way rather than reuse it through recycling.
So when I throw that plastic yogurt container in the trash,
right,
and as opposed to rinsing it and putting it in the recycling bin.
Correct, yeah.
Well, you actually kind of took an interesting journey of tracking what you generated in trash for 2 weeks. What did you learn?
How difficult it is to track your trash. It's really tough to decide when something becomes your trash. Right now I'm drinking out of this paper cup,
mm-hmm.
which you, you know, your producer yes. so kindly provided for
yes.
me. And, you know, at the I don't know, there are two baskets
yes.
here, but if I just left this here
yeah.
on the desk here, would this be my trash or would this be Michigan Radio
okay.
trash? So that's part of the problem. And also, what about the manufacturer of this cup?
Uh-huh.
Are they responsible for creating the trash?
Hmm.
So that was just, I mean, that was
yeah.
the toughest part, was deciding when something became my own rather than somebody else's.
What did you learn about what you throw away and perhaps what you went, what we could all do differently?
Well, I learned that it's really not so tough to make these minor adjustments. I mean, we're not talking like a huge lifestyle change
mm-hmm.
here. This is, you know, using the, if you have the option in the bathroom, use the blow dryer or the dryer, the air dryer, rather than the napkins or
yeah.
the paper. Yeah. Or using less of them when you can. When you have the option of recycling, do so. Don't use a plastic bottle. You know, use like you have here. You have
mm-hmm.
the reusable bottles.
Yeah. So yeah, that I fill from the tap.
It's these minor adjustments that you can make. And of course, there's more to it than that. But these minor adjustments are a good start. And I mean, if we all made that, think of the impact that would make.
Now, archaeologists have learned over the centuries. I actually studied archaeology in college.
Okay.
And it was fascinating to realize what the Bronze Age people in Ireland were living like by
mm-hmm.
studying
mm-hmm.
the trash
right.
that was found in
right.
those digs. So you learn a lot about a society and people about what they throw away. So what do you think our landfills say about us in 2013?
Well, I think Mike Garfield from the Ecology mm-hmm. Center said it best in my piece. And he said, you know, that people are going to look back, you know, 40, 50 years from now and say, why the hell was everyone throwing away all this good stuff and putting it into, you know, and just covering it up with dirt when they could have been reusing it?
So we hope that we'll see that fact 50 years down the road or so, that things
right.
will be reused.
Yeah.
Writer Mark Kurlianchik's piece is called Waste Matters. Thanks so much for talking with
Thanks
us
so
today
much for
on
having
Stateside.
Me.
And we have put a link to Mark's piece on our website. Just go to michiganradio.org. And now we bring you a late-breaking update on Supreme Court Justice Diane Hathaway. Her attorney says she will resign from the bench effective January 21st. This comes after the Michigan Judicial Tenure Commission filed a formal complaint against Justice Hathaway. The disciplinary board alleges Justice Hathaway is guilty of fraud, money laundering, and lying in violation of ethical standards covering the judiciary. You can find up-to-the-minute information about her story online at michiganradio.org. Stateside is engineered today by Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. And our executive producer and director today, Mercedes Mejia. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.